This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Grant Smith, is familiar to Takes on the World listeners as the go-to person when it comes to examining the network of organizations that make up the Israel lobby and the modus operandi in maintaining influence over Congress, its most important occupied territory. As director of the Washington-based IRMEP, the Institute for Research of Middle East Policy, he has written a number of key books on the topic, including two histories of AIPAC, America's Defense Line, the Justice Department's Battle to Register the Israel Lobby as Agents of a Foreign Government, and Foreign Agents AIPAC from the 1963 Fulbright hearings to the 2005 espionage scandal, as well as Divert, about Israel's theft of nuclear-enriched uranium, spy trade that deals with the U.S.-Israel Free Trade Agreement, and his latest, Big Israel, How Israel's Lobby Moves America, published last year, that provides key details about the extraordinary network of organizations that make up the pro-Israel lobby, which we talked about last time. On that note, I'd like to welcome Grant Smith once again to Takes on the World.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Well, Americans can't open newspapers or magazines today or listen to the radio or watch TV without hearing the mantra, Russian meddling in our elections. They don't even use alleged anymore. In your book, Foreign Agents, in 2007, you document real instances of a country's influence in our election process. That country was Israel, and if anything, it has been ongoing.
Absolutely. The whole idea that the Russians could in any way approach the level of meddling and direction in terms of election activity in this country compared to Israel is just amazing to anybody who's read about it. But, of course, many people haven't, and that's part of the problem.
Well, you might give, in your book, you give some instances. This was even reported, actually, in the mainstream press at the time, which, believe it or not, my dear listeners, did actually carry articles about AIPAC from time to time and its malinfluence on U.S. politics, but that seems to have gone out the window.
Right. No, the instances of meddling are clear. I'm hoping that we get to the whole discussion about how AIPAC was, in essence, ordered to register as an Israeli foreign agent in 1962. I mean, this is a foreign agent in terms of all of the criteria that is now being looked at in terms of Russia, in terms of having the sole purpose of getting donations for a foreign country, the idea of its various networks and funding, and in fact, the fact that it received seed funding from overseas, not just Americans, but actually donors in other countries to establish itself. And so that has to be at the very base of any discussion of the biggest organization, successor to the American Zionist Council. But in terms of election activities, which is what you asked about, there have been numerous instances, the most important of which was when AIPAC was discovered setting up and then directing political action committees to favor and coordinate their donations so they could, as efficiently as possible, get candidates who wanted or were willing to forward an Israeli agenda in the U.S. political system elected. And that was the subject of 20 years of court action by various organizations and individuals who objected to this, had excellent documentation of how AIPAC was coordinating all of these supposedly independent political action committees, which do not, by the way, have Israel in their name, so that they could get these candidates elected. And, of course, that went to the Supreme Court back, and it was thrown out by a judge who said, basically, well, laws have changed so much now, two decades later, that this is no longer relevant. There's the instance of 1986 when AIPAC Director Michael Goland helped get Alan Cranston elected to the Senate by funneling a bunch of cash to spoiler candidate Ed Vallon. There were felonies involved in that, and people actually were prosecuted for it. But, of course, you don't redo elections after a pro-Israel candidate has been elected to office. And, of course, we have numerous instances of non-election activities by AIPAC, including an all and out espionage effort that has resulted in basically the theft of $144 billion from U.S. industry and trade groups when AIPAC coordinated with an Israeli government agent to steal U.S. industry data from groups that were opposed to passing Israeli trade preferences. So this is really just a record of incredible activities that are not present in this discussion today.
Well, you mentioned Anna Cranston, so we're in California. Cranston was famous for the Cranston Amendment, in which he, when Israel owed the United States money, he made sure that a public law was enacted that the amount of money that the U.S. would give to Israel every year would be more than enough to pay Israel's the amount that Israel owed to the United States. And I remember when there was a debate on Nightline about Israel getting requests for $10 billion of loan guarantees, and Stuart Eisenstadt, a Carter administration member, said, well, the Israelis always pay us back. And David Obi was member of Congress and sometimes critical of Israel. He said, that's because we give them the money to do so. And and Ted Koppel should have said, what? He should have stopped right there and asked the question. But he went right on because that was something no one talked about.
Absolutely. Well, it reflects sort of a disinterest in asking the penetrating follow-up questions that are, you know, typical in this discussion.
Well, that would, of course, be a prima facie reason for requiring Alan Cranston to register as an agent, as a number of our members of Congress who periodically run over to Israel, give press conferences denouncing their own president on behalf of whoever happens to be the Israeli prime minister. Usually it's Netanyahu, their prime minister for life these days. But in your books and in your work, you have documented, and then you, even as I mentioned in my introduction, you actually made a serious attempt to carry out President Kennedy's wishes by getting AIPAC, the current iteration of American Zionist Council, to register. Tell us what happened with that event.
Right. Well, we managed to get declassified actual Justice Department documents that revealed what was going on during the Fulbright inquiry into Israeli foreign agent activity. May want to reference your readers to an article that came out called AIPAC Still Our Biggest Foreign Agent, which talks about what was going on in the 1963 and 1962 period. But the whole purpose of the Fulbright inquiry was that there was an increase in incidents, according to a classified Senate document, of examples where representatives of foreign government were conducting activities offshore and onshore for the purpose of influencing policy. And he cited the Lavon affair, of all things, which was referring to Operation Susanna, an Israeli terror attack on U.S. facilities in Egypt back in the day. But just to really look at what is the follow-up on this, there was a Justice Department Foreign Agents Registration Act order that was given to the American Zionist Council, the very top Israel lobbying organization in the United States. And just 6 weeks later, an unincorporated part of that, which was called AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, it was just an unincorporated committee, split off and took over all of the activities. So I would say that it wasn't a successor to the AZC. It really was the AZC. This was essentially a failure to continue enforcing that Foreign Agent Registration Act order. And so because the Justice Department documents were classified until 2008, and we were only able to get a hold of them at that time, we assembled them into a document which had the unambiguous title of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee is an unregistered foreign agent of the Israeli government. People can see that in the article I just referenced. It's linked there, all 300 pages of it, and brought that to Heather Hunt on November 3rd of 2009 with a group of IRMEP supporters who have been following this issue for a very long time and sat down with her and her team for what was supposed to be a one-hour meeting. As we went point by point through all of these declassified documents and the actual harm that had resulted to the United States as a result of the non-enforcement of the FARA order, the individuals in the room began to take an interest. And when the time expired, the initial hour we were allotted, they said, no, keep going, we want to hear more. And so we went over the free trade agreement espionage incident. We went over Michael Goland. We went over the 2005 incident where two AIPAC employees were indicted for stealing national defense information in the interest of getting the U.S. into a war with Iran. And they said, proceed. And, of course, the meeting wound up, hands were shaken, business cards were passed around, and absolutely nothing has happened since 2009. There's no indication that the Justice Department FARA Registration Unit has made any move to enforce their own order. And it's for people who understand what AIPAC really is and where it came from, it's infuriating.
What I recall, wasn't there a someone else in the room sitting far at the end of that table, you described it, who didn't give us any, give out a business card?
And, yeah, there
and
were,
was the one
there
who kind of was
mysterious
like
man,
a, like
still
a
don't
minder.
Know who he was.
Like a minder.
Some sort of minder.
To well, make sure that he was Apex man, obviously, there.
Possibly. I mean, maybe it was Neil Scherr, who was an APAC guy who went to the Justice Department and actually, you know, took over a bunch of operations there. Who knows? But, you know, one of the interesting things is you really can't do very much in a federal agency before you meet a minder, before you meet a gatekeeper, somebody who is going to be interested in seeing whatever public accountability is supposed to occur gets shut down. So I can say that hasn't been an unfamiliar circumstance in 15 years of doing this.
You know, it's interesting, the original head of the American Zionist Council was a Canadian named Cy Kennan, and at one point he was registered as a foreign agent, as I recall.
Yeah, he worked for the Jewish Agency, which was a quasi-governmental outfit headed out of Jerusalem, which was involved in setting up the state and lobbying for it at the UN. He later became a registered foreign agent for the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He told the Justice Department he was leaving specifically to lobby for the Israel government, met with the head of the FARA section in the 50s and said, this is what I'm going to do. Do I need to register? They said yes. They passed him the forms, and he never did. So that's who formed AIPAC, a foreign agent who was basically still funded by the Jewish Agency through his lobbying newsletter, the Near East Report, for decades. It was a conduit for seed funding for him to continue his operations. But, you know, some of the people who got a hold of these documents after the Jewish Agency offices in New York were raided, you know, they knew what was going on. They knew exactly what Kennan was. And, of course, what did he do during the Senate hearings? You know, maybe this is something that'll happen with some of these people presenting today. He fled the country. He left. He left until he was assured that he wasn't going to be criminally prosecuted. So, you know, it's very interesting. When you actually have facts about the maneuvers of the lobby over time and not just from newspaper clippings, it can be very interesting. It almost looks like a spy story.
Now, if the lobby, if the American Zionist Council, let's say the American AIPAC, had registered, that would radically, as I mentioned earlier, change the way it and other Jewish organizations who are primarily devoted to supporting and lobbying for Israel could actually behave. I mean, today we have members of AIPAC sitting in on congressional staff meetings, providing interns to congressional offices. And when AIPAC offers you an intern, you don't turn him or her down, which is like putting a spy in every member of Congress's office they choose to do with an intern. Could that have happened? If AIPAC had to register as a foreign agent, could they have these big conferences in Washington every year with half the members of Congress attending?
Absolutely not. I mean, one of the things they would have had to have done, that I would argue they're required to do, is file a report every 6 months detailing their meetings with the Israeli government. I mean, that that disclosure is what makes nobody want to register as a foreign agent. I mean, in this country, you can be a foreign agent. You just have to be open about it. But, you know, in the first instance, Isaiah Cannon and all of his staff would have had to detail every single meeting that they held with the Israeli government. As it is today, you know, the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, Malcolm Holmline, is in Israel every other week. He meets with the prime minister. He gets his instructions. They decide on strategy. Then he comes back and he coordinates with all of his member organizations, which, you know, are the most important 50 organizations in the U.S., and delivers marching orders. That would not be able to happen if the Foreign Agents Registration Act were enforced. Old Malcolm would have to fill out his Foreign Agents Registration Act disclosure every 6 months. People could go into the FARA office or to their website and download the report and say, okay, what were your discussions with your foreign principal, you know, last week? But instead, none of that happens, and so it's had a cascading effect. The most important, which may be the coordination of donors and stealth political action committees that have an absolute dominant position on many U.S. congressmen and senators, to the extent that they do not believe, and probably correctly so, that they can form a campaign, get elected or reelected if they don't comply with the wishes of these PACs and Israel affinity donors. So none of this would have been possible. None of the scandals I mentioned would have occurred if there had been the warranted transparency of actual foreign agents and their activities in the United States working for Israel.
Now, I recall Cynthia McKinney was the last member of Congress to actually criticize Israel publicly and unequivocally, saying when she went to run for Congress, someone from AIPAC comes and has her, asked her, or they volunteer to write a statement offering support for Israel. I remember when the AIPAC put out this Near East report, public report, they would have the relationship to Israel or statement about Israel by every prospective member of Congress, whether they had been to Israel or they were planning to go to Israel. Of course, they have all these free trips to Israel. You might mention that before we shift topics.
Well, right. Stephanie Chirac, who is a major campaign fundraiser, made a statement that's on YouTube now. People should look it up. Basically saying that the step that you took before you even put together a campaign was to make this policy paper to AIPAC, and most of her candidates simply found other candidates' papers and copied them and made a few changes and sent them, effectively pledging them to AIPAC's program. And this is before they even have a campaign. As she says, this is what you get to get the money to mount a campaign, much less, you know, run for office. So it's a sad state of affairs. Cynthia McKinney obviously didn't play ball. She's one of the many heroes who went down and fell on her sword for not being willing to sign a pledge to a foreign country in order to get into office, which should raise everyone's, you know, hair on edge, realizing what the rest of the members of Congress who actually got into office had to pledge. And it's, you know, people are rightfully suspicious of that, and they should be.
Well, my guest is Grant Smith, the director of Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. Well, let's look now at one of the results of the failure of AIPAC to be forced to register. It's this new piece of legislation in which the United States has now gone on the side of Israel against the United Nations and the European Union in threatening to imprison and fine individuals or companies that support or participate in the boycott, sanctions, investment movement toward Israel.
Right. We're talking about the Israel Anti-Boycott Act,
yes.
H.R. 1697.
Yes.
In the Senate, it's S-720. Essentially, it is targeted most tightly at the United Nations Human Rights Commission, which is creating a database of businesses in illegal settlements and having quite an impact. It's one of the things the Israel lobby is very concerned about. They want to protect businesses in the occupied territories. They want to outlaw any UNHCR or international organization boycotts of settlement products. They want full implementation of the U.S.-Israel Strategic Partnership Act of 2014. And so, you know, there is some media coverage of this. And the latest is the ACLU explained these criminal penalties to the lead Senate sponsor, Senator Cardin, saying, you know, in effect, you've got to fix this legislation. You've got to make it less draconian, focusing on free speech. But this law is not about free speech. It's about inserting policies of a foreign government into the core of three different U.S. laws. And the questions that should be raised is, how is this in any way appropriate to insert Israel in the middle of laws about U.S. national security? Now, these three laws are so complex and Byzantine, it's incredibly difficult to see the cascading effect of this act into the other laws. But the right questions are, the first law that it's calling into action is the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. The first question Americans should ask is there a national emergency at this point on the level of the Korean War, the postal strike, the 1933 banking crisis? And the answer is no. There isn't a national crisis affecting the U.S. It's not a national crisis that Israel is facing boycotts over its human rights violations. So that's something that has not been discussed and needs a lot more discussion. The other is, why are senators and congresspeople like Ben Cardin spearheading this? And it's really, you know, it's not too difficult to figure that out. Senator Cardin is not as concerned about free speech. He's not as concerned about jailing Americans or others for engaging in human rights activities and free speech, because he is heavily dependent upon this Israel lobby that we're talking about. And just to make it perfectly, you know, clear about the key sponsor of the Senate side, if you look at Senator Ben Cardin's campaign to get reelected in 2018, and you look at his 2017 donors, his top donor in terms of PACs is NORPAC, which is an Israel stealth PAC, which just this year has given him $39,700. His second big PAC donor is the Washington Political Action Committee, $10,000. That's another Israel stealth PAC. If you look at the rest of the top 20, 86% are Israel affinity donors who are members of Jewish federations, Birthright, former AIPAC presidents, Board of Governors of Technion in Israel, which is one of their nuclear weapons research facilities. It's, you know, it's incredible to see this, and you quickly realize, at least examining the top 20, that Ben Cardin's top constituent in terms of campaign contributions is not Maryland. It's clearly Israel.
Well, he has a long track record of supporting Israel, so he's actually giving his donors what they pay him to do, which is considerably more than he gets from the U.S. taxpayers. So I guess you go where the money is.
Well, it's incredible, though. I mean, we actually did a poll a couple of weeks ago, basically asking, you know, this is what Zionism is. Are you a Zionist? And 70% of Americans are not Zionists, and they don't support this type of legislation. They don't support any legislation impacting Americans' right to engage in boycotts. And yet here you have a senator, the key senator, who pretends he's ignorant about what's in his own proposed legislation, who wants to modify it at the margins, and claiming that this is a U.S. interest, but it's truly despicable.
It's interesting. A number of people, including Rabbi Joseph Berman of Jewish Voice for Peace, who was interviewed on Democracy Now! The other day, criticizing the legislation, but he said the AIPAC was pretty much like the NRA, National Rifle Association. But that is, of course, it's an easy argument to make, but unfortunately it has no basis in reality. Perhaps you explain why.
Well, it doesn't have any basis in reality, because whatever you think about the NRA, it's concerned with the U.S. Constitution, in particular, in this case, the Second Amendment. When you're talking about Israel, you're talking about a foreign government. You're talking about an expansionist, settler colonial state, which has engaged in many activities including espionage against the United States, including theft of nuclear materials and technology to arm its nuclear weapons, all sorts of things that harm the United States. It's half of the reason, according to the 9/11 report, that we were attacked on 9/11. The Israel lobby, which supports all of this, is not as American as apple pie. It's really an advancement of a foreign ideology, precisely what Farah was designed to thwart. So when you hear these arguments that this is all about free speech, this is not about free speech. This is about positioning a foreign country at the core of U.S. laws through a tiny minority that's pushing this through Congress in order to implement hardcore Zionism at the center of America. You know, again, 70% of Americans don't support this, and yet you can be sure that there's not going to be enough reporting on this. There's not going to be enough effort to keep this from passing. It'll be another assault on the United States, just like the 1984 AIPAC Israeli government assault on U.S. industry, which will have incredibly bad consequences. And there will never be, at least in broader circles, a serious discussion about what's really going on.
Well, also, I would add that there are a number of members of Congress who from time to time have frequently criticized the NRA. You have editorials and newspapers that criticize the NRA, but there's not a single member of Congress that I'm aware of who has stood on the floor to criticize AIPAC or even mention its name, let alone Prime Minister of Israel, where it was quite easy to criticize the President of the United States on the floor of Congress, but I don't recall the last time. Well, actually, it was when Shamir was the Prime Minister of Israel. 38 senators, Republican and Democrat, wrote a letter to Prime Minister Shamir. This was back in the late 80s, I think it was, criticizing his reluctance to engage in peace negotiations. And these were distinguished members of the Senate. There's no radical section, but they were well-known members. They put their name on a letter, and they got slammed by the pro-Israel lobby. They got slammed by it. You do not talk against Israel on the floor of the U.S. Congress. If that's not an occupied territory, the evidence for saying, I don't know what is. Listeners to this program, familiar with me referring to Congress as Israel's most important occupied territory, but I would say that this ability to prevent or keep from having to register as a foreign agent is much more important to Israel in the long run than having nuclear weapons. What would you say to that?
I would say that's true. You know, having influence over the United States, which, by the way, having the nuclear arsenal also is essentially providing the same influence. But this is much more important because, as one very pro-Israel figure wrote in Newsweek, the country doesn't have much going for it. Its human rights record is terrible. There's an increased focus through social media and alternative media on what's actually happening. They've really lost the youngest generations in particular. In surveys after surveys, you see the youngest generation just isn't buying it because of where they get their news. So I would agree with all that. This argument and this new legislation is particularly disturbing because it does something that's already happened, and that's using emergency powers. Again, I talked about the Emergency Powers Act, which was last invoked in 2001 to create a unit under heavy AIPAC lobbying at the Treasury Department, the Office of Foreign Assets Control. It really takes the same approach. It creates a new unit at Treasury or, as it may be, at an export administration center in the U.S. It creates special powers, and then they can suddenly prosecute people for free speech. They'll get the Javed Iqbal treatment. As you remember, Javed Iqbal was showing some Al-Manar, some Hezbollah videos over his own cable network, wanting to present another side to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And he thought he would get a First Amendment pass on that type of activity. But no, the Treasury Department prosecuted him and threw him in jail for 6 years, essentially because they had seized power under this Emergency Powers Act and are now able to disregard and throw away the First Amendment and prosecute people the Israel lobby doesn't like. So this is a real threat. This is another seizure of power, just like the 1984 seizure of American trade secrets to pass the free trade agreement. That's going to have incredibly negative effects. But the real questions Americans should be asking are, is my senator or congressperson, are they acting on the interests of Israel or are they acting on the interests of the United States? There are many of them who feel that they owe Israel and its lobby payback for having passed an extremely good law, an extremely good agreement, the JCPOA, not that they had much to do with it, it was mainly the President, Obama, to regulate the Iranian nuclear program so that neither Israel nor the United States could attack Iran on the pretext that they were manufacturing nuclear weapons. So they're all, many of them, like Cardin, think they have to pay Israel back for having passed a law that most Americans wanted and that has worked very well, not that it was necessary. But this is an extremely dangerous law. People will go to jail. They will get the Javed Iqbal treatments. They can claim, you know, First Amendment rights all they want. But because the Emergency Powers Act is being invoked and inserting Israel for the very first time in the middle of a U.S. national security law, they're not going to have a foot to stand on. So this is outrageous, but people are not going to hear about this power grab.
Well, what's interesting is the authors of this particular legislation, we hear that AIPAC contributed to the writing of this bill. When you read this piece of legislation, you realize this was not written by a member of Congress or a member of Congress's staff, unless it was someone placed in their office by AIPAC. This is clearly drawn up by AIPAC, and AIPAC has put the passage of this bill high up on its agenda.
Right.
And yet, when it was introduced, I didn't see any mention of it in the U.S. media.
No.
It's like there's no discussion. I remember years ago I did an article for Lies of Our Time. It's one of the few magazines left of center that went out of business, probably because of my articles on the Israel lobby. But I'm serious. I was going to doing an article on USAID to Israel and found out that the previous 8 years before I did the article, this was back in the 90s, I could not find a single mention in the U.S. press of aid to Israel when they wrote about foreign aid. They would have a 20-inch story in the New York Times, no mention of the fact that Israel was getting several billion dollars. So this is, we see they have literally all bases covered, and this is actually the end result of thwarting President Kennedy's desire to have AIPAC or American Zionist Council register as a foreign agent, which it clearly was. There's no other country has organizations working for in the United States. And yet this has seemed to become part of the territory, part of the atmosphere, like mountain ranges and seas and oceans. There's Israel, part of the American political system. And there's nowhere in the Constitution that allows such a thing to happen.
Right. We're all supposed to be the fish just swimming along, and we're not supposed to notice the water. But this is, you know, again, we're drowning here. So we're not fish. And it's very interesting. It's supposed to be just part of the scenery. But people really have to ask, you know, where is this bill coming from? Why is my senator or congressperson who's passing this getting so much funding from stealth PACs and individuals who have well-known connections to the lobby? And why aren't they talking about whether it's appropriate to insert a foreign country in the middle of U.S. national security legislation that has been on the books for a long time? They should ask, what's the emergency? There is no emergency. You know, it's not an emergency that Israel is destroying its international reputation. It's not an emergency that people of good conscience are organizing boycotts. It's not an emergency that the United Nations, one division of it, has concerns and wants to do something about it. Those are not American emergencies. And whether or not your congressperson or senator can't count on getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars from stealth Israeli PACs, that's not an emergency. That's not a reason for them to thwart their own constituents.
And what's really interesting is that they make the UN Human Rights Council, but more importantly, the European Union
right.
as the enemy. They spell out the Europe International Government Organizations, the term, quote, International Government Organizations, it says, includes the United Nations and the European Union. So here is the United States standing with Israel against the world. There is something seriously wrong. Graham, I want you to tell people about your website and your books and how they could get more information, because they're not going to get it from many other radio stations, I'm sure, about that.
Yeah, a key place to check out is irmep.org. That's got all the current reports. Our Twitter feed is embedded there. People should also check out the Israel Lobby Archive, which has all of the declassified documents from the Justice Department on the Foreign Agents Act that was issued to AZC/APAC. So that's an extremely important website. There's a link on every website that simply says conference series, and those are joint conferences with the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs that occur in Washington, D.C. It's the only conference that discusses the Israel lobby in the United States with excellent speakers from the United States, from Israel, from Palestine, who understand the issues. The last one had Hanan Ashrari, John Mearsheimer, Ilan Pappe, and many others. So please check out those websites.
And it's also distinguished by the fact that no national media gives it any coverage, although C-SPAN did a couple of years ago cover the entire conference, but that was like an anomaly.
Right. Well, people can usually watch it streamed online. So to the extent that alternative media and alternative channels are blossoming, it almost doesn't matter whether someone from the New York Times or Washington Post comes and writes, you know, what are usually not very relevant articles. So they're online. Go online.
Okay. The website, my guess is Grant Smith. The website is IRMEP, IRMEP.org. It's a treasure trove. Grant, thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World and filling us in on this very important question.
Thank you, Jeff.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.